From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters, life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we pick up where we ended on our previous broadcast and present more of an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank is talking with Brett McCracken, senior editor for the Gospel Coalition and author of The Wisdom Pyramid, Feeding Your Soul in a Post-Truth World. Well, let's now join Hank Hanegraaff and Brett McCracken in their conversation.
When I was reading through your book in the chapter of Nature, I wrote down this quote by Albert Einstein, who saw himself as a little child entering a huge library filled with books in many different languages. The child knows someone must have written those books. It does not know how. It does not understand the languages in which they are written. The child dimly suspects a mysterious order in the arrangement of the books, but doesn't know what it is. That, said Einstein, it seems to me, is the attitude of even the most intelligent human being toward God. Now, Einstein rejected the personal God of the Bible, but he saw that design presupposes a designer.
Yeah, no, I love that. And it's interesting to kind of see the scientific community and the more that is being discovered about the size of the universe and the complexity and the finely tuned nature of the universe. There's more and more skepticism about things like Darwinism and just kind of secular explanations. And yet there's still this reluctance to say that it was God, but the design of things is more and more unsettling for the secular scientific establishment, because the more that science discovers about the universe, the more it's clear that this is even more ingeniously designed than we ever thought. And that's both in the space level of bigness and it's in the micro level of the body. And the deeper down you go into like the micro levels of DNA and, you know, the smallest elements of the human body are miraculously designed, and it's crazy. This is why nature, for me, is so foundational in the wisdom pyramid. I have hopes that the science and faith division for the next generation can kind of bridge it again, and we can have more and more orthodox, in the lowercase o, Christians, mere Christians who are in the sciences, because I think there's a lot of beautiful harmony that can come when we read the two books together, right? You know, the book of scripture and the book of creation.
One of the things you write about poignantly in the book is identifying with your local community. The intention being that perhaps you shouldn't live a long ways away from your church. Perhaps you should be concerned about the people in the periphery of your neighborhood. The idea of localism, we sometimes want to solve problems on the other side of the globe when there are problems staring us in the face every single day. I thought that was a very significant part of your book.
Yeah, I think part of the foolishness of our age is that we're all being drawn out of the local more and more, right? Whether it's the news and, you know, we're more interested in the national news and we're more aware of like national political debates than we are about local issues. You know, with this last election, I guarantee that if you ask the average voter, you know, tell me about what you're voting for on this election, they would know more about the bigger picture kind of statewide, or, you know, if we're in a presidential year, they would have a stronger opinion about the presidential candidates. And they might not know anything about the local school board election or the local ballot initiatives. And I think that's a problem because, you know, this connects with the whole embodiment idea. The fact is, we are created as embodied creatures who live in a place, a physical place. And God created humans to cultivate the earth in the place that they are, to bring order, as it were, out of the chaos, wherever they are found. Our vocation is not to be aware of the chaos on the other side of the world that we can't do anything about. Our vocation is let's survey the chaos in our immediate sphere of influence, which starts with your own family oftentimes. Are you bringing order there? And then are you bringing order in your local neighborhood and your local city? So yeah, localism is a huge value for me. I think it's a lost value in the digital age. The internet just disciples us in a direction away from localism. And I think the church needs to recover that, because the local church is where individual Christians are formed and developed, is in community with real people that you can know and be known by, that you can pop over to their house, you know, and, you know, have a conversation and bring food over, you know, if someone is in need. It's hard to disciple one another. It's hard to grow alongside other people when you're far physically from one another. So yeah, I mean, in my book Uncomfortable, which is all about the local church, I think I say something like, you know, when you're picking a church to attend, basically throw a stone at the nearest non-heretical church and go there, you know. The local matters. And I think that driving an hour away to your church is a weird thing to do and not advisable.
I want to get back to what you're talking about with respect to nature. One of the points you make in your book is that urban living is literally changing our brains, rewiring our brains. We live in a concrete jungle, and as a result of that, we oftentimes cannot appreciate nature. It's so interesting. At the same time I was reading your book, I was reading a book titled Where the Crawdads Sing. Very, very popular book. And one of the themes of that book is nature. It's very interesting. The author is a materialist, sort of a person that has the worldview that the physical facts fix all the facts. But yet, the beauty with which she describes nature, the intricacies of nature, stunning. There were times when I was reading that book that I actually had tears in my eyes. But this point of urban living desensitizing us to the beauty of God's book of nature.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very real thing for me, because I live in dense Southern California, where it's like city for as far as you can see. And I feel it, like I feel my soul lacking something. And so anytime we get the chance to like go a little bit out of town to a state park or the beach or something, like we seize that opportunity, because there's just something, there's something about being in nature and being encountered with nature in its pure form that we need, right? There's like a magnetic pull to that. And I think it's because it reminds us that we are creatures. We are part of this creation. We are not the creator. And when you live in an urban environment where everything is climate controlled and you can kind of exert your will on nature to some degree, you're not confronted with the fact that you are a creature. You start to have these delusions of being the creator. And that's where foolishness arises. You know, I think it's interesting that cities, and I don't want to go too far down this trajectory because it's not true in every sense, but, you know, cities in the Bible oftentimes have connotations of evil and kind of being against God, you know, whether it's Sodom and Gomorrah or Babel. And even to this day, cities are, they tend to be more secular, you know, more anti-God in their character, not always, whereas rural environments that are a little bit more in tune with nature and the cycles of nature maybe have, it's a bit easier to kind of be religious and to acknowledge God. I think there's just something there to observe, right? Like the more you're in an environment where nature is kept out of view and you're not confronted with the limitations of being a creature in creation, I think the more you can live without God. Why do I need God? Like, I'm my own God in this urban kind of oasis of man's kind of apotheosis of man's creation. Whereas if you're a farmer in North Dakota, you are very much aware of your limitations as the creature, because you are totally reliant on the weather and God's prerogative when it comes to the weather and the seasons and the cycles and the design of nature and farming and whatnot. So if we live in an environment, you know, whether it's we're talking about cities and urban environments or just digital environments where we're looking at screens all day, right? You could live in farmland of America in the middle of Iowa And you could still have this problem if you're spending all day, every day looking at screens and not going outside, you know? So I don't want to suggest that only people in cities are falling into this trap. It's happening all over the world through technology. The point is, whatever we're doing to distance ourselves from God's creation in nature, the worse off it is, I think, for our groundedness in the structure and the design of reality.
One of the sections of your book, Chapter 7, has to do with books, and I actually wrote in the margin, the reason Brett is so interesting is he reads so many books. And I want you to expand on that, because it does promote discipline, it enlarges your vocabulary, it enhances your memory, your creativity, your ability to reason. It has so many byproducts. So I want you to do a pitch, as your book does, on the importance of reading.
But don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with author Brett McCracken. With access to an endless stream of addictive information, acquiring wisdom has become increasingly difficult. At a time when so much of our daily media diet is toxic and making us spiritually sick, The Wisdom Pyramid by Brett McCracken shows us how to become wise by reorienting our lives around God and Christ, the foundation and truth and the eternal source of wisdom. Be sure to read The Wisdom Pyramid, Feeding Your Soul in a Post-Truth World by Brett McCracken. To receive your copy of The Wisdom Pyramid, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. Dr. Eben Alexander's wildly popular near-death experience book, Proof of Heaven, assures us that no matter what we do in this life, only unconditional love and joy await us in the world to come. But our Lord warned that while the gate to hell is wide, the road to it broad, and those who enter through it are many, the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. Your generous support lets Hank Hanegraaff and CRI speak out against the lies that lead to hell. In appreciation for your gift today, we'll rush you Hank's book, Afterlife, What You Need to Know About Heaven, the Hereafter, and Near-Death Experiences, filled with answers to your questions about life after death. Call 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org now. Again, that's equip.org.
Did you know that you are an important part of God's plan for the Bible Answer Man broadcast in the Christian Research Institute? CRI is supported by people like you who share our mission to equip Christians to give an answer for the hope we have. So every life-changing broadcast and resource is made possible by your prayers and gifts. As our world concludes the challenging year of 2022, consider the famous lines from C.T. Studd's poem, "Only one life, 'twill soon be past. Only what's done for Christ will last." For those of us who have set our hearts and eyes on eternity, that's an important reminder. Please partner with Hank Hanegraaff and CRI at this crucial time. Call 888-7000-CRI. That's 888-7000-CRI. Or visit equip.org. That's equip.org.
This, then, is the climax of divine revelation, God with us. The infinite has progressively revealed himself in accordance with our finitude. Thus, prior to Emmanuel, general and special revelation revealed his glory. But in the incarnation, we have seen his glory. Thus writes Hank Hanegraaff in his book, Incarnation, the Ultimate Self-Revelation of God. In short, God's incarnation in human flesh is the apex of revelation, his last word. In taking on human flesh, God gives us more than the clearest image of who he is. He gives us himself. To receive your copy of Incarnation as our appreciation for your financial partnership, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches, or visit equip.org. Equip.org. Let's rejoin Bible Answer Man host Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, Brett McCracken, in their conversation.
One of the sections of your book, Chapter 7, has to do with books, and I actually wrote in the margin, the reason Brett is so interesting is he reads so many books. So I want you to do a pitch, as your book does, on the importance of reading.
Oh, wow. I mean, there's so much I could say about it. I grew up, first of all, with a father who was a huge reader, and it's one of the traits about him that I'm so thankful for, because I grew up seeing a stack of books always on his nightstand. And every time I saw him with free time, he was sitting there reading books. And so I think this is a generational thing that we really have to model for our kids. If we want our kids to have any chance of being good readers, you know, they need to see us reading, and we need to read books to them. You know, I have three little kids under the age of 4. So they're not quite to that age where I can like read Narnia to them for the first time. But I can't wait for that day, because I want them to have the experience of the magic of reading. And, you know, one of the great things about reading books is just how transporting they are. You know, you could be a little middle class kid in suburban Kansas City, which is what I was growing up, and you could be reading books about, you know, pirates in the Caribbean, or, you know, historical characters in Europe or throughout the world. And so there's a real sense of like visiting other eras and other places and gaining a broader view of God's great, majestic, diverse world through books. You know, you don't have to have a huge bank account that affords you the luxury of traveling the world to experience the world. You know, books and narratives like that can do that. There's a book by the novelist Marilyn Robinson called When I Was a Child, I Read Books. And she has a beautiful little essay in that book where she talks about being kind of, you know, a little girl in the Midwest growing up, and how books were her friends. Like, she looked at her bookshelf and it represented her community, you know, whether it was Huckleberry Finn or some other character she was reading, like this was her community. And so reading books, it can connect you with other people in a communal sense. It can develop empathy, you know, for other perspectives that you might not have access to in your particular context. And it can just broaden your world and develop curiosity to keep exploring that world. And maybe that's the biggest thing I would say, is the muscle of curiosity is so essential in the life of wisdom. If we have no appetite for learning and for growing and kind of developing in all these ways in our wisdom, then we're not going to do it. So whether it's books or beauty or nature, like things that just stir our hearts to like want to explore more, to go further up and further in this grand expanse of God's world, that's good for our wisdom, you know? So whatever it is for you, whether it's, you know, reading the Hardy Boys, which I read those books voraciously as a kid.
Nancy Drew probably as well.
Nancy Drew, like Berenstain Bears, like it doesn't really matter what it is. Honestly, I don't want to be like a snob and say like, you only need to be reading the great books. You know, it really just read what you love, like read the books that give you that transporting kind of experience of being taken to another world, being exposed to a different perspective, and just enjoying the beauty of narrative and the creativity of man, you know?
You know, you're also connecting with great minds. So, for example, I can read St. John Chrysostom, is a great series of sermons in a book. It's titled On Wealth and Poverty. But you're reading that book, and you're connecting with a great mind. Yeah. And that mind was very much alive when he was writing that book. So you have that opportunity of connecting with somebody that is brilliant. And the examples that you give, I mean, you've talked about C.S. Lewis, but some of the great scientists like Johannes Kepler, who faithfully read the Bible, he voraciously consumed a wide variety of books, and he resolutely fixed his substantial talents on the book of nature because he said through it, God spoke to him as a father to a child.
Mm.
And also something that you talk about in your book, books, you say, give us perspective, focus, and space to reflect. I mean, that last clause, space to reflect. And we've already talked about this, so maybe it doesn't bear elaboration, but I think it's so important that when you read, you can reflect, and you have that space where with digital media, oftentimes you don't, or at least you don't allow yourself that space because of the immediacy and the rapid pace.
Yeah, I think that's a really good word. And, you know, I find myself tempted when I'm reading books to move on too quickly because there are way too many books out there that I want to read and are on my to-read list. I'm sure you are the same way, Hank. Like, there are so many good books always. And sometimes I'm like so eager to get through my Amazon to read list that I don't sufficiently take time to like sit with a book. And so that's a habit that I'm trying to work on in my own life. But, you know, it's just in our whole digital world, that's going to be a struggle for us, like, because we are so inundated with content, you know, in every media form, whether it's physical books or Kindle books or podcasts or movies or TV shows or articles, there's just so much of it. And again, a lot of it is really good content that contains a lot of truth and nourishment. But if we're not taking time to let each individual thing that we consume actually like process a bit, and even to the point where we think critically about it and evaluate it, and, you know, we can do that while we're rereading too, like you can kind of evaluate and write things in the margin, and I do that. But I do think there's something about not moving on too quickly so that the nourishment, whatever nourishment you got from reading that book, isn't just kind of like in one end, you know, out the other instantly. Like, we've got to take time to synthesize.
You quote C.S. Lewis, who said, read one old book for every three new books. And actually, that was challenging to me because I was thinking, when I read that, do I do that actually? What about the classics? And I, as a result of that, I went to the library and I got some of the classics. And I thought, you know, for every three books, because I get so many books sent in to me and I'm always reading a new book. And sometimes that crowds out the classics, but the classics are so transcendently important.
I think it's a brilliant suggestion from Lewis. And I think if we all attempted to do that, you know, maybe we can't do as well as one for every three, but one for every five, whatever you can do, I think it's a good habit.
But you also say that if you read only challenging books, it's the intellectual equivalent of eating only organic greens.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's the whole, like, we can't look at the Bible as broccoli idea. Like, if we're seeing the development of wisdom as a chore that is kind of soul crushing over time, that's not going to be good for us. So our hearts and our loves need to matter. And so choose books that actually give you life and stir your affections in positive ways, not just books that feel like homework.
Part of your pyramid includes beauty, and you talk about how beauty silences us, and it's so necessary to be silenced in a noisy age. Maybe you can speak to the synergy of silence and beauty.
Yeah, in the book, I connect this to Sabbath and just the theology of the Sabbath. And, you know, God had, he had a design in mind when he instituted the Sabbath, right? Because it's connected to this idea of, by our human nature, I think we want to just constantly be productive and just filling every gap with something. So to actually like force ourselves to kind of take a break and to be still, it's everything that we've been describing today when we've been talking about the need for silence and the need for contemplation and the need for rest, to be reminded of our limitations. And we're not just these hyper-productive robots that can just consume. Like, we need to have space to synthesize. We need to have space to let something powerful have its full effect on us. And so, yeah, I think the arts and beauty, they necessarily force us to slow down, because so often art is just too complex to kind of understand it in the moment. You have to like sit with a painting at a museum for a little bit to fully grasp its meaning, you know. And literally, when you're going to like a concert, you have to kind of sit still for a couple hours. That is a revolutionary thing in today's busybody age. Like, just sitting silently for a couple hours, whether it's listening to music or watching a movie, that's increasingly becoming a radical act. Who would have thought, you know, 50 years ago that like going to the movie theater and sitting in the dark for 2+ hours and giving your full attention to this experience of beauty and art, that that is a radical thing. But it is, because we live in this world where we can't go 2 seconds without pulling out our phone and like scrolling. And so I think the arts, you know, need to be a part of our habits and our wisdom diet, because they do force us to slow down a bit and they train our muscles of silence and contemplation.
You have really lived up to the mission statement of this podcast. This again is a podcast that is exposing you to people that expand your horizons. And I think reading the book, The Wisdom Pyramid, will do just that. You can get a copy on the web at equip.org. So on for now.
Thank you for listening to this special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, Brett McCracken. To hear this Hank Unplugged podcast interview in its entirety, go to equip.org, iTunes, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. Our firm commitment here at the Christian Research Institute is to defend the faith once for all delivered to the saints and equip believers to become true disciples of Jesus Christ. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand CRI's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches, Hank would like to send you a copy of The Wisdom Pyramid, Feeding Your Soul in a Post-Truth World by Brett McCracken. Call a resource consultant at 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or visit our website, equip.org. That's equip.org. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters, life matters more. Dr. Eben Alexander's wildly popular near-death experience book, Proof of Heaven, assures us that no matter what we do in this life, only unconditional love and joy await us in the world to come. But our Lord warned that while the gate to hell is wide, the road to it broad, and those who enter through it are many, the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. Your generous support lets Hank Hanegraaff and CRI speak out against the lies that lead to hell. In appreciation for your gift today, we'll rush you Hank's book, Afterlife, What You Need to Know About Heaven, the Hereafter, and Near-Death Experiences, filled with answers to your questions about life after death. Call 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org now. Again, that's equip.org.